Well, thank you, organizers, for organizing this workshop and for giving me an opportunity to talk here. I'm going to talk about the work which is done in collaboration with Paul Wigman and Eldad Bettelheim, who is coming probably today or tomorrow. And I mostly talk about the work which is on ConMat, shown here. And I have to thank graduate students who helped me with numerics a little bit. I'll show some pictures. Okay, so it's now spring in Australia, and right at this time when we are sitting here, some people in Australia are preparing their gliders to observe the fascinating phenomenon. So it happens here in the Gulf of Carpenter in northern Australia. And pictures which I'm going to show are taken from this website, and you have much more pictures on that site. So there is a fascinating phenomenon which is called rolling clouds or morning glory. So every morning, like early morning, the breeze is blowing from the sea, and people here on those islands and on the shore see clouds which look like this. So these are really long sausage-like looking clouds, which are of dimension about 1,000 kilometers long, and they move to the shore with a speed of 40-60 kilometers per hour, so it's pretty fast, and they also are rotating in the direction opposite to their motion. That's why they're called rolling clouds. And apparently these clouds, and there is a lot of sports there, and people are...
Are they moving along their long axis?
No, they're moving... They're moving orthogonal to the long axis, so it's like one-dimensional motion. So everything is uniform in the orthogonal direction. Of course, movie cannot be found. Okay, let's see what we can do. So this is the view from the top, from the plane. So people gliding on top and they're watching those clouds. And those clouds have been identified with the soliton solution of Benjamin Onna equation, which is not shown here. I'm using Pasha's computer, so that's my computer is here, but it's this annoying beep, so we'll come to my computer if it will not work. Not at all. Okay. So before movie, I'll show equation. No, it should be fine. Okay.
These are solutions of Benjamin Onna equation,
which is shown here, and which is derived in a stratified fluid. So many of you are familiar with the KdV equation, which is defining, derived in this geometry. If you consider the shallow channel, and you consider the waves of the wavelengths, which is much bigger than the depth of the fluid, then you can reduce your hydrodynamic equations to one-dimensional nonlinear equation, which is called Kertovic-Defreeze equation. If you do the same, but in a stratified fluid, when you have lighter fluid on top and heavier fluid on the bottom, and you consider the regime when the wavelength is much bigger than the depth of the upper fluid, but much smaller than the depth of the deep fluid, then you obtain another nonlinear equation, which is called Benjamin Onna equation. It was proposed by Benjamin in 1967 and then developed by Onna in 1975. And it has very standard Riemann equation type term, the time derivative and nonlinear term, plus dispersive term, which looks a lot of like KdV, but it has two derivatives only, and this H means Hilbert transform. So this is not actually differential equations, but integral differential equation. So Hilbert transform is defined by this formula, and basically the story about Hilbert transform is that its Fourier transform is modulus, Fourier transform of this term is modulus K times K. It's absolute value of K times K. So, and And those clouds have been identified solitons of this equation, and the main that happened long ago. So the main problem which they have now is how to generate those soliton equations and whether they really fit numerically solutions of the equations. And it seems that the answer is positive, so those clouds are solitons of Benjamin Hall equation. So now I want to switch to blackboard, and I will mostly use blackboard.
Benjamin Hall are also integrable?
It is integrable, yes. I will talk in detail about this equation. Yeah. There is even one more equation which interpolates between them for the fluid of intermediate depth, and it is also integrable. So it's the same, but the kernel here is more complicated.
Is it possible to simulate this in the lab?
Yes, that's what they did in the first place.
Changing the orders of magnitude.
In 1967, when Benjamin wrote this
paper,
he actually tried himself immediately to do it in a lab. And he said that his lab was not did not really show affirmative that those solitons, actually this equation possesses solitons, and that's the easiest way to check it, to see whether solitons exist. But at the same time, the Davis and Akrivas did experiments and pictures are beautiful. It's 1967, so it was confirmed. So 67, yes. And then people did a lot of experiments, and in particular those at Davis, they did a lot of measurements, and apparently it seems to fit. Cold and hot air. You mean in atmosphere? It's usually just you have cold air in the bottom and hot air at the top, and we just see those solitons because of the mixture on hot and cold air, and that's why the vapor condenses, and that's why we see it. So this is what's unique about that place, that you have the mechanism which generates those waves on a regular basis. So I'm switching to blackboard, and let me write this equation once again. And the definition of the Hilbert transform of the function is the following. It's the integral in the principal value sense y minus x. So for us, it's convenient to know several things about this Hilbert transform. First of all, the Fourier transform of the Hilbert transform is I sine k times fk. So basically, in the Fourier space, making the Hilbert transform is just multiplication by sine k. Therefore, in particular, you if you do linearization of this equation in Fourier transform, you will see that solution is given, this term disappears in a linear approximation, and there is you can always of course add here term which is just can be removed by the choice of reference frame, which will give you the linear dispersion. Okay, so what happens is that this term, the coefficient beta here, gives you correction of the type beta k modulus k. That's what you can easily check by taking a Fourier transform of Hilbert transform and double derivative. So index here denotes the partial derivative with respect to x and t correspondingly. Okay, so if you have a disturbance of the typical size U capital and the typical length L, then you can compare those terms. In particular, this term, nonlinear term, is of the order U squared divided by L, and this term is of the order of U divided by L squared. So when they are the same order, namely U is of the order of 1 over L, you expect the nonlinear term and dispersive term to be in kind of balance. And this equation is very special. It is integrable, so they are in balance. And this results in the existence of the special solution, which propagates without changing its form, soliton solution. I will write explicit formula for this solution. So let me call this coefficient alpha. Can we remove this? Probably, because I don't need it for quite some time. So this is the one soliton solution of Benjamin Ohm equation. It has Lorentzian shape. The maximum amplitude is when this term is zero, so it's for alpha v. And the width is of the order of 1 over v. So indeed, you see that they are in balance. As it was shown, the typical height is of the order of 1 of the width. And this v is nothing else but the velocity of the motion of the soliton. So the way it looks like is that there are Lorentzian-shaped solitons, and the velocity of the soliton is higher if soliton is more narrow. Moreover, the integral of u of x t dx is equal to 4 pi alpha with this normalization, and it does not depend on other parameters. So if you change the width of the soliton, if you make it narrow, it goes faster, but the total area for all solitons is the same. This is very special for Benjamin Ohm equation. It's not like this in, say, KdV equation. So the area of solitons is quantized in some sense. Alpha here is just coefficient here. Well, yeah, I switched to alpha. So, of course, if you look at this equation, all these terms have different dimensions. So the fields can be rescaled, u, x, and t fields can be rescaled, and all coefficients can be put to 1. It's just convenient to keep track of alpha for future. But basically, one can always rescale this alpha away. So one more thing about Hilbert transform is that, which is convenient and which is convenient to show that this is indeed solution, is the following, that, yes.
How the dimensions work out? Is there some rescale or?
Yeah, if you rescale x, t, and u.
Explicit solutions. 1 over v has the same dimension as the length somehow.
That's right, but I already rescaled quite a lot of variables here. Everything has dimension of 1 over length.
Oh, everything has dimension
of 1 over length. Yeah. So u has dimension of 1 over length, and t and x of the same dimension, because I absorbed the velocity. Okay. So, it is easy to check that this is indeed solution, and it's done in the following way. The convenient way to write Hilbert transform is the following, that if I decompose my function f of x in the sum of two functions, f plus of x plus f minus of x, where f plus of x is analytic in the upper half plane, and f minus of x is analytic in the lower half plane. So this is x-axis, and I consider those functions as I decompose my function as the sum of two, which up to analytic continuation will be analytic in upper half plane and lower half plane. Then Hilbert transform is a form of I f plus minus f minus. So in particular, if function is analytic in upper half plane, then when you do Hilbert transform, it's just getting multiplied by I. And this solution is nothing else, but you can write it as 1 over x minus z plus, well, I minus 1 over x minus z star, where z is some point in the upper half plane. And when you do Hilbert transform of this, you will obtain the sum of similar terms, and the rest is just algebra to check that this equation is satisfied.
Sorry, f plus is the analytic continuation?
All functions are functions of the real variable x, and f is a real function. So what I do is I write it as a sum of two functions, which are complex now, of the real variable x, such that f plus of x can be continued to the upper half complex plane without singularities, and f minus can be continued to the lower half plane without singularities.
So all the real x is f plus and f minus are different.
That's right, yeah.
This is
complex conjugated, huh?
This is unique.
That's right. Yeah, there are explicit formulas for f plus f minus. But basically what you do is, it's a very simple story. You do Fourier transform of f, and then you just write sum with positive k and sum with negative k. These are f plus and f minus. So you can easily see that. In the Fourier transform, it's really obvious. Okay, so what about n soliton solutions? Does this equation have n soliton solution? And indeed, it does. And the way to look for it is that it's a Poulenc dot. What I'm going to do is I'm going to write u of x t as a nonzerz, which is given by the following formula. Plus complex conjugate. So what I assume is that all dependence on time is independent of those complex parameters on time. And I will also assume that all zj's lie in upper.
How does the denominator 2 times alpha?
2i times alpha. So alpha is a coefficient here. So this is Polanzatz. And I assume that this equation has solution which has just poles moving in time. So all time dependence in the time dependence of those poles.
So you
have the same residue. That's right. Residues are the same, so these are poles, the same residue, which just the positions of poles move in time. And if I substitute it here, I will see that that the equation will be satisfied if there are special conditions on the motion of poles, which can be reduced to the following, that the double time derivative of zj equals minus d over b zj. Which is this type. So if the motion of poles, the time dependence of poles satisfies this equation, then this will be solution of Benjamin on equation. And this one is Hamiltonian system. This is Hamiltonian system, and this is called Kolodziej-Ramoser system in mathematics. Well, in fact, this is finite dimensional integrable system, and explicit solution exists in terms of determinant of some metrics. So one can go further, and one can write explicit time dependence of CJs. So we can see that, well, physicists know Kolodziej particles, which are particles moving on one line and interacting with potential, which is 1 over x squared. And this looks like the motion of particles which are governed by this potential. But the difference is that those points move in the upper half complex plane, not on a straight line. So the interpretation of this as a system of particles is not quite good. So we will fix it a bit later. And the one more remark about Benjamin on equation is that it's a Hamiltonian equation. Namely, one can reproduce this equation starting from the following Hamiltonian, h equals integral over space of u cube over 3 plus alpha dx h. Well, one has to be precise. Well, of course, one needs not only Hamiltonian, but Poisson bracket. So classical Poisson bracket should be given by the following formula. So one can easily check that if one has this Poisson bracket, then commuting u of x with Hamiltonian, one obtains Benjaminian equation right away.
Is there a quantum analog of this equation?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So there will be quantum analog.
Uh-huh.
And you can have here several different terms. For example, KdV term has uxx term. Almost nothing changes here except that this term will become ux squared, so it contains two derivatives instead of one. So when you find Poisson bracket with it, you will get KdV. Or you can add here uxx term. This is Berger's equation, but then you're in trouble. You will not be able to find Hamiltonian, because if you just by dimensional analysis write something like ux, it will be full derivative. So Berger's equation is known to be non-Hamiltonian because this term corresponds to dissipation. So, but this one is Hamiltonian, and in addition to Hamiltonian, it has infinitely many conserved quantities. So let me write a couple of them. So one of them already mentioned, this is just integral of u, the area. It is conserved trivially by this equation. The next one is integral of u squared divided by 2 dx. So this is momentum of the system, it's also conserved.
Sorry. This is equations of motion of the collateral model.
Almost, except that those z's move in a complex plane instead of straight line.
Does it mean that that doesn't prove that the original equation is integral, that's for the particular answers?
Sure, yeah, that's right. No. The fact that this particular finite dimensional reduction of the equation is integrable is known for ages. The integrability of Benjamin-Lon equation was also proven, so it is also proven and it is integrable.
That's an independent.
That's more complicated, sorry. Yeah. As a hint that it is integrable, I will say that it has infinitely many conserved quantities, which is not yet integrability, but yes.
Maybe you have just answered that the formula you wrote over there, U is not integrable with respect to anything you want to integrate.
Oh, it is, because there is a complex conjugate here.
Oh, okay.
And together they will give Lorentzian kind of shapes,
okay,
which is integrable. I integrate with respect to X.
On the line.
And that's right. Because of the conjugate, I get expression like that, and it is integrable. Okay. So the number three expression is just our Hamiltonian, which starts with u cubed divided by 3, and then there is one more, which it starts with 2 to the 4. I will just write it as an example. I will not actually use it. U squared u x h plus 2 alpha squared u x squared. So one can actually find those even by trial and error, although there are more intelligent ways to do that. But you can basically see that these are polynomials in u, u x, and u Hilbert transform. So you can find those coefficients of polynomials so that it's conserved. And so on and so forth. There are infinitely many of such integrals of motion. So moreover, there is, of course, there is a periodic solution, which is obtained from basically from this solution by periodic continuation. So let me write it somewhere here, because I'm going to return to that solution. Or periodic solution. Are just parameters. So you plug in parameters here, p, q, and k, and this solution satisfies Benjamin-Lon equation. And what basically the way it looks like is it is just some periodic wave which moves to the right with a velocity p plus q over 2 to the right. And the shape is funny, and it interpolates when those coefficients is small, it's more or less harmonic, so it looks like a cosine. But if p goes to q, if this limit, these things become well-separated solitons of the Lorentzian shape. So you can obtain one soliton solution in the particular limit of p minus q going to 0. You come back to soliton. So, but this is the solution p, q, and k parameters. That's an infinite energy, yeah. So you basically have to calculate energy per period if you want some reasonable estimate. Okay. So this is the first part of the story, introduction to this Benjamin-Lon equation. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go to physical Clausius system, and I will argue that this Benjaminian equation or similar equation describes the collective dynamics of those Clausius particles on a straight line. It's almost here already because this is the Clausius equations, except that those Z's are not confined to one-dimensional lines, so one should do some tricks. So let me write with the Hamiltonian of Clausius-Sutherland model. So these are one-dimensional particles which live on a straight line, characterized by their coordinates xj and momenta pj. And this is a coupling constant, lambda times lambda minus 1. It's traditionally written this way. And you can think of this system both in a quantum sense and in a classical sense. So if you want to think about this classical Hamiltonian, then pj should identify with the variable which is conjugated to x. If you want to do it in a classical sense, you should think that pj as k Poisson bracket is delta jk. So in classical case, it is not convenient to use parameterization this way, but it is more convenient to write down lambda squared here. And the reason will be clear very soon. Also, if you really want to study thermodynamics, it is useful to confine this system to the parabolic potential x squared. Now I want to keep both quantum and classical models. So in quantum case, I will call this coefficient lambda times lambda minus 1. In classical case, I will call the same coefficient lambda squared.
Lambda being always
real number? Lambda is real number, yes. Okay, yeah, I will consider lambda bigger than 1, for example, just to make it repulsion. Okay. So, first of all, there are interesting particular cases. First of all, you can easily find the ground state of this system. And the ground state is given by the following expression. It's a product of I smaller than j, xi minus xj to the power lambda, e to the minus omega over 2 sum over j, xj squared, with harmonic potential. So this is the ground state of the system. You can easily check that it is an eigenstate of Hamiltonian, and you can easily prove that it is the lowest eigenvalue which corresponds to this state. Notice here that, now I'm talking about quantum problem, now notice here that if I interchange xi and xj, I will get non-trivial statistics. Namely, the phase will be pi lambda phase, not standard symmetric or anti-symmetric. In particular, there are two interesting, and this is the way I'm going to treat it. I'm going to treat those particles interacting with this potential as some kind of anions, particles with fractional statistics. And of course, in one dimension, statistics is not that important, so you can remove the statistics, but then you have to really think about correction to this Hamiltonian, which consists of some contact interaction which takes care of this phase. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to consider just particles with fractional statistics. The case lambda equals 0 corresponds to the function to be 1, well, times exponent. Well, let me write it without exponent. And this is obviously the system of non-interacting bosons. The potential here for lambda equals 0 disappears. I have free particles, and the ground state is 1. So this is a system of free bosons. If lambda equals 1, that's another interesting case, because when lambda equals 1, this term disappears. And so again, I have free particles. But then statistics is anti-symmetric, so when you interchange particles, wave function changes sign, so this corresponds to free fermions. So the way to check this, the easiest way to check this is to rewrite Hamiltonian in the following form. So let me write Calogero model Hamiltonian in the form 1/2 sum over j qj dagger uj plus some constant, where qj is tj plus I lambda, sum over all k which are not equal to j of 1 over xj minus xk. And in the presence of harmonic potential, I should also add minus I omega xj. So the Calogero model can be written in the following way identically. This Calogero model. So, okay, Calogero Sazonov, CS. Well, okay, it's called Calogero because Calogero suggested this model, but then Sutherland suggested the periodic extension of this model on a circle. So usually, called Calogero-Sutherland model is reserved for the system with periodic boundary conditions. So this is usually called Calogero model. But then there is Moser, who wrote a lot of papers of mathematical content and more or less at the same time. So mathematicians know this mostly as Calogero-Moser systems. Physicists use the word Sutherland more often. And so there is Calogero-Sutherland-Moser systems. They considered our classical models in the first place. Then quantum Calogero, well, Calogero and Sutherland considered quantum model. Moser considered mostly classical systems of those equations. And they also have a lot of different other generalizations, which I'm not going to talk about. Calogero model system, yes, I referred that for poles being everywhere. Yeah, that's right. So let's just call this Calogero model, and that will be our terminology for this talk. Okay, so looking at this Hamiltonian, and it's easy to check that the qj times psi 0 is 0, and therefore this psi 0 is indeed a ground state of the system. You cannot go lower than that, because this is supposed to be positive, or non-negative, so 0 is the lowest eigenvalue possible. And you can easily see how it's done. If you try to act on psi 0 by those operators, then when you act by derivatives, the factor of lambda divided by xi minus xj goes down and cancels this one precisely. And exponent cancels this one. So it's indeed easy to check that this is a ground state. So the classical equations, well, this decomposition works also in classical case. And now I do not even change the definition of my qj. And that's why I use lambda squared notation here. When you do classical, the lambda times lambda minus 1, this 1 appears when you act by derivative of qj dagger term to this factor of the qj term. In a classical case, these are not derivatives but numbers, and then we just get lambda squared without that quantum correction. So the equations of motion can be written in the following way. These are just Hamiltonian equations of motion. And I wrote this formula just to show you that this is indeed the same system, except that my xj's belong to the real axis with the real coordinates of the particles, and zj's are auxiliary coordinates of poles in Benjamin Ohm equation. In classical case, it's lambda squared here again, instead of lambda times lambda minus 1. So what I'm going to argue next is that if I'm looking at the limit of many particles here, and I want to describe the system in terms of density and velocity and hydrodynamic description, then those hydrodynamic equations will be similar to this Benjamin Ohm equation I started with. Well, you can already see the similarities at the level of motion of poles, but this similarity can be continued beyond that. And to show how, to give you some feeling of what is the hydrodynamic description, I will start with this particular case of free fermions, lambda equals 1, because everybody understands free fermions. So So I'm consider one-dimensional particles with Fermionic statistics, non-interacting, and I want to describe those particles in the limit of many, many particles in a semi-classical limit. That's right, although you have to take care about statistics, yes. Yeah.
Suppose I impose canonical and conditional equations on
the right
side, but have this interaction.
Yeah.
Then there is a fermions or anion or.
What you have to, the easiest way to write it as a sort of free particles would be to use operators which is the canonical psi times exponent of the convolution of density with logarithm like a string. Then this will take care of the commutation relations. So it is possible to write it as a free anions, a kind of Hamiltonian.
No, but I'm saying the question is, are there different series in which fermions interact in this way and another anions interact in this way? Are these different series?
That's right. That's ambiguity of one-dimensional knowledge of statistics and parameters. So you can always think of this Hamiltonian as not complete Hamiltonian, but one having some local interactions like delta functional type of interactions, which will change statistics of your particles if you want. So what I want to do is I want to consider this as a complete Hamiltonian but with non-trivial statistics here. So, but you can think about this as fermions with this interaction plus some additional local interactions which will essentially make them anions. But I'm not going to take this route. So let me move on to free fermions where there is no problem about statistics. The way I'm going to describe free fermions is using the phase space picture. So this is my coordinate x, and this is momentum p. And I'm going to choose some particular area in the phase space, and I'm going to fill it with particles in a semi-classical way. Namely, I will divide it into boxes, each box of the area 2 pi h bar. And I will think of one fermion sitting precisely in the center of each box. And this is my quasi-classical state of free fermions. Not any state, of course, because, for example, one can also easily fill this part, which is disconnected from this one. Or one can also do these things, which are intersect vertical line in several points. I will not consider those states. I will consider only particular subset of states, which are characterized by this star-like shape. Okay? So, well, if I do this way, then I can characterize easily this distribution of fermions in the phase space by two functions of one variable, k right of x and k left of x. So this is the right Fermi momentum and left Fermi momentum. When I gave this talk to statisticians once, they said that they usually call it top and this is bottom. But we understand that this is a positive momentum, which means that on the line it goes to the right. That's why the name k right. So I assume that every state in between k right and k left is fixed, is filled with fermions. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to calculate trivially what is the density of fermions at the point x for this state. Well, the density is given by the integral over wave vector from k left to k right, divided by 2 pi h bar, but I will drop h bar, which is k right minus k left divided by 2 pi. Then the current, which I will parameterize as density multiplied by velocity, will be integral from k left to k right, the momentum of particles times the number of particles, which is k right squared minus k left squared divided by 4 pi.
Wait, I'm sorry.
Yes.
If it's semi-classical, where are the Fermi statistics?
Fermi statistics in the fact that I put only precisely one particle per box.
That in and of itself is not Fermi statistics.
Why? This is the semi-classical way to think about statistics. I do not occupy the same state. Well, this state can be represented as slater determinant of some coherent states. So precisely this state. So this is just pictorial way of thinking about that, if you want. But basically, that's I can write this coherent state of one particle coherent state, which is corresponds to this box picture, which has average momentum in this range and average position in this in this direction, and then I take slated determinant of this. This will be approximately this state. Okay. Let me say one word about what I call semi-classical limit in a second. I will write a couple of formulas and then I'll explain. I by semi-classical I mean very special thing, so not the conventional one. So the velocity.
Wouldn't you take the
cut head
and that
kind of
classical
limit? That's right. Yeah, you
report exactly the same thing.
I will make a comment. You can do precisely everything which I'm doing here in semi-classical picture. You can do precisely this using Bosonization technique at purely quantum level. I will comment on how it goes. This is just the good way to visualize it. But you can do precisely everything under the quantum level. So let me divide this expression by this one to get velocity. I will get k right plus k left over 2. So what this strip means is that the width of the strip is the density. It's given by difference k right and k left. And the center of mass of the strip is the velocity of fluid as a whole. Okay, finally, I need energy.
Wait, so what, I mean, the quantization of the Fermi field is not in there yet. I mean, I guess that's why it's semi-classical.
What is quantization of Fermi?
Like you can only add a part, just one particle at a time.
Well, you're asking the question of, okay, this is some shape in the phase space, which actually doesn't have meaning in purely quantum case at all. So this is a classical description. And in particular, you can ask, you can replace this with a more precise description in terms of the Wigner function, and this is the density of a Wigner function. No, but I have infinite system, so yeah, that's right. Yeah, you have to impose this as additional constraint in this semi-classical description. That's right. Quantization of particles is not here yet.
Yeah,
absolutely, yeah, that's right. Okay, and then this becomes k right cube minus k left cube divided by 12 pi. And as you can see here, k right left can be written as velocity plus minus pi rho, just from these formulas, from velocity and density, you can easily see that. So you can rewrite it in terms of density and velocity only, and you obtain the more familiar expression rho squared over 2 plus pi squared over 6 rho cube. So what I say now is that I have a system with Hamiltonian, which is given by one-dimensional integral dx of the density of the energy pi squared over 6 rho cube. So I describe my system in terms of bosonic fields, velocity, and density. The only memory about statistics in this term, which is due to the Pauli exclusion principle, due to the fact that I filled my picture in this way. So this is my Hamiltonian. Of course, for Hamiltonian, I need also commutation relations. I will come to them in a second. So where is h bar here? Let me restore h bar for as an exception. So if I put m divided by h bar here with velocity, and then I put h squared over m in front, then this is the correct with mass of the particles and h bar. So you can see that if you really take h bar going to zero limit here, I call it classical, then this term survives because h squared here cancels h squared here. And this is classical, truly classical term, rho v squared over 2 is just kinetic energy of the fluid which moves this whole. But this term disappears. So the exclusion principle disappears if you go to classical limit. So what I actually mean, I want to keep this term on the same order as this term. So my limit is I take the limit of h bar going to 0, and I take the background density, rho 0, going to infinity, in such a way that h bar times rho 0 is constant. And I call this semi-classical limit of refermions. Otherwise, I do not have anything interesting. This term disappears. So I actually consider quite dense systems of refermions. OK. So. like everything.
Would this work at higher dimensions?
Not only in some special cases like quantum Hall effect or superfluid. So generally not.
Yes, it's a bit of a, I mean, you would like to think it's terminology, the semi-classical limit, you think would not only, if you could find something only works in one dimension, it's a little.
Okay. So I have this Hamiltonian, and I can write equations of motion. Let me skip that part. So I obtain equations of motion in a hydrodynamic form, which are the following: the continuity equation and Euler equation. So this term comes from the internal energy of the free Fermat system. And you can see that this is very special form. For example, what you can do, you can multiply this equation by pi and plus minus the second equation. And you see that these terms combine in a full square.
You started saying something about computational relations.
That's right, yeah. Let me go to that. I'm talking about semi-classical limits. So these are classical equations of motion. So if I add those and introduce the notation u right left, which is the same as k right left, which I used before, which is v plus minus pi rho, then I obtain that these two equations separate. And in particular, you have equation u right p plus u right x equals 0, this equation. So this u is the position of right Fermi momentum. And this equation is the same equation for u left. And actually, you can write this equation right away starting from fermionic system because, you have to understand how this system moves. So these are free fermions. So every fermion here, every box, moves to the right with a velocity which is proportional to the momentum. So system goes like this. So everything moves to the right on top and on the left to the left on bottom with velocity proportional to the distance from the real axis here. So in particular, the system will be completely described by the position of on the boundary. And this k right does not change if you sit on a particle which is right here. So my true hydrodynamic derivative, which is the time derivative, partial time derivative, plus velocity multiplied by space derivative, should be zero. So I immediately see that this is my correct commutation relation. And you will find from here, you will find the equations on the rho and v, if you want, and to get them from the same energy which I used, you have to use the fact that rho of x, v of y, Poisson bracket, should be delta prime of x minus y.
You're almost doing bosonization.
That's right. And this is the next thing I wanted to say, is that this is a semi-classical picture. You can do precisely the same bosonizing your free fermionic Hamiltonian, and you obtain precisely the same result, precisely the same Hamiltonian, but rho and v now are quantum operators. And my u right is nothing else but v phi right, the right field, and so on and so forth with the canonical commutation relations between fields.
There should be somewhere a linearized equation which describes the chiral
wave. That's right. If you now consider the Hamiltonian H, which is rho v squared over 2, plus pi squared over 6 rho cubed. And now you say that your rho is rho 0 plus phi prime, and your rho v current is minus phi dot, then linearizing that, you obtain precisely linear bosonization, which people usually use. And this is the main argument, that people usually use linearized version of this equation, which are just wave equations, but there are a lot of phenomena where nonlinear nature of those equations are important, and this is what I'm after. But nonlinear terms and dispersive terms. Okay. So let me skip derivation for Clojure model, assuming that you already motivated enough to believe the result, which I will write. Yeah. The gradients of K I assume to be small. Yes, that's right. I do not want anything to change on the size of the box here of that elementary boxes. So the gradient should be small enough. But I want to keep those corrections. There are still nonlinear effects and there are still gradient corrections.
And that's energy.
In Kolodziej-Rosazon model, but not in free ferments. In free ferments, this is you can show that this result is exact. There are no corrections.
Is that the same as the energy of the excitation small compared to Fermi energy?
No. I can consider excitation far away from Fermi energy. Well, strictly speaking, I'm not talking about single quasi-particle excitation. I'm talking about coherent states. I can consider the state with which density, which is as far as you want from the background density, but not single particle excitation, which are far away. Okay, so let me write down the same system for Kolodziej-Rosazon model. So W of rho is the enthalpy per particle, and it is given by the following formula. And this corresponds to the Hamiltonian, which is rho v squared over 2 plus rho epsilon of rho. This is the general form of the Hamiltonian, which has Galilean invariance, so this term is obvious. Epsilon of rho is expression similar to this one. Fortunately, it has simple interpretation. So let me write epsilon of rho and show interpretation. So let me consider this energy per particle, and this term is obvious, generalization of Pauli exclusion term to fractional statistics. In fractional statistics, if you take lambda large, then the size of the box here should be 2 pi lambda times h bar. So the system with lambdas bigger than 1, they are stronger than fermions. The picture in this case, which I draw here, is not simple a phase space picture, but the picture which comes from asymptotic beta ansatz. So I characterize my system by beta function, and then I characterize the distribution of roots by my density in phase space in this particular case. And what's nice about the beta ansatz for Kolodziej-Rosazon system is that usually the rho of k is a complicated function of the momentum. In this case, it's constant equals lambda, 1 over lambda. So this particular beta ansatz is very simple. So Kolodziej-Rosazon system is as close to free fermions as you can imagine. The only parameter is lambda there. So this term is just Pauli exclusion principle. Let
going from a free fermi system to a Bollinger liquid, essentially that term, if you linearize bosonization.
No. That's it. By the way, I think I missed. Okay, no, that's right. No, that's not coming from linear bosonization, as far as I understand. Okay, so what about this term? This term in the Hamiltonian is a term proportional to lambda lambda minus 1, rho rho x h. So let me write just down what it means explicitly. It's integral over dx, rho of x. Instead of this, I will write dx, and then I will write Hilbert transform explicitly dy. Rho of y minus x. This is Hilbert transform. So when I take derivative here, I will get y minus x squared. So you obtain that these are densities which interact with 1 over x squared potential. So this is just precisely the term of this type, which is rewritten in terms of densities. Of course, this is more subtle than that because at the point of coincidence of particles, you have to regularize expressions in particular way. But this at least should show you that having Hilbert transforms in the energy of the hydrodynamic focalization is a very natural thing, because this corresponds to 1 of x squared interaction. Okay? And again, this expression is a quantum expression. Can be done in classically every lambda minus 1 should be replaced by lambda. So it will be lambda squared here and lambda squared here. But in quantum case, it also works. Rho and V are non-commuting operators then. And you can see also that when lambda equals 1 precisely, then this term disappear, and you end up with your free fermionic hydrodynamics.
Okay. But if you linearize this theory, you should get a Lagrangian liquid, presumably.
That's right. If you linearize everything, you get Lagrangian liquid, because Lagrangian liquid is quadratic approximation, right? So if you linearize this, you will get again rho squared here with slightly different coefficient, which is lambda, and this is what was obtained by Kawakami and Young long ago, and so on and so forth. So
the other terms give you what? I mean,
the other terms you usually do not consider when you talk about Lagrangian liquid. So they were derived by Javitsky and Sakita in the context of matrix models and string theory long ago.
Yeah, when you're interested in large density deviations, that's any one of those terms.
That's right. Yeah. The large density deviation, I need to take into account that this is cubic, not quadratic. And this one I need if I'm thinking about gradients.
Is the Lagrangian liquid a fixed point of this field if you look at very long distances?
So that's what people believe, yes. So quadratic approximation to this, and if you study simple asymptotics of simple two-point correlation functions, they are given only by quadratic terms, and they will be, you can think about them as Lagrangian liquid approximation. However, if you're going to consider the phenomenon which I'm going to talk about in the left 5 minutes, then you obviously see that this is not Lagrangian liquid in any way.
If the phenomena has a cutoff that doesn't allow you to go to the fixed.
That's right. So there are different quantities which you can calculate, and some of them are not possible to go by the normalization group all the way.
I mean, short distance phenomena you don't expect.
Okay. Large density deviation.
Not only. Let me give you some example, which I should have showed in the Benjaminian equation already. So suppose that I start with some disturbance like this in the hydrodynamic equation. There are two interesting effects. One is nonlinear effect, which tells you that the upper part of this hump propagates with velocity larger than the lower part. The term UUX in hydrodynamic equations, this is basically a velocity term, means that velocity gets higher when you go to the top of the disturbance. So sooner or later, it will become like this. And that's called gradient catastrophe. So gradients here become infinite. Usually, in the presence of dissipative term, the finite discontinuity forms, and this is called shock wave. And then to really see the structure of this shock front, you have to use the hydrodynamics with dissipative terms. Without dissipative terms, you can consider the structure outside and look conservation laws to predict what happens with this shock wave. This is what usually done in hydrodynamics. Here, I do not have dissipation. But I have dispersion. I have terms which are proportional to higher order of gradients, which will become important here. So the question, what will happen? In the presence of dispersive terms, but not dissipative terms, it's known that this becomes oscillating here. So it oscillates, and then it spreads out. So as a result, this bump will decay into the train of solitons, which propagate to the right. So this is solitons with large velocity, small, and very small velocity. The number of those solitons will be proportional to the area of initial bump. So this is new phenomenon, and obviously in linearized approximation you cannot describe this. In linearized approximation, this bump will move to the right without changing its shape, no matter what initial shape is.
So this is just a density of disturbance which propagates.
That's right.
Solitons.
That's right. Yes. So what I'm going to do next is to do the following. Think. Let me take those equations of motion with this complicated W of rho, and let me first of all choose chiral sector. So I will consider only right moving modes, And it turns out that you can do that. So you can impose the following special condition. You can always do it in hydrodynamics, but in this particular case, you can do it exactly, so not as an approximation. So let me show you what kind of condition you should impose, and then what you will obtain. So suppose that I start with some initial distribution such that the velocity, I characterize initial distribution by velocity and density. So, but suppose that they are related in the following way. The velocity equals pi lambda rho plus lambda minus 1 over 2 dx log rho to the h. What I'm doing here in my fermionic, free fermion language, corresponds to the following initial state. I will completely say that there is nothing on the left Fermi surface, but on the right Fermi surface I make an excitation. So this is the analog for this equation. So what happens here is that everything propagates to the right, there are no left propagating modes. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to use this equation and find what happens with those two equations. And it turns out that they both become equivalent under this constraint. So they support this physical constraint exactly. And in particular, you obtain the following. The one equation which you obtain will be the following. So this is the one equation. It's only on density because velocity is completely defined by density. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to linearize this equation. Well, not linearize, but I want to leave only terms of the lowest order in nonlinearity and in dispersive corrections. So in particular, instead of log rho, I will write log rho 0 plus delta rho. And I will notice that this is log rho 0 plus delta rho divided by rho, 0. Then I take h from here, it will be h here, and I multiply by rho 0, I will get delta rho xh. So what I obtain is the following. I obtain the following equation, ut plus uux plus lambda minus 1 divided by 2, well, with one constant h over m, uxxh equals 0, where u here is 2 pi lambda h bar over m delta rho. And the full density rho is rho 0 plus delta rho. So I'm saying now that if I consider small deviations, so my background density rho 0 is large, and I consider small disturbance in the chiral sector here, that actually it goes back to original Benjamin Onna equation. And I can borrow a lot of results which are known for this equation. In particular, this phenomenon of dispersive shockwaves is studied in this Benjamin Onna equation. And there is a beautiful technique how to match those two solutions of dispersive-less equation with the modulated periodic solution, which is exact for Benjamin Onna. So I do not have time for that, and hopefully my movie will work, so I'll show you how this looks like. But
can I ask one other question?
Yes, sure.
I mean, this works in the quantum regime, is that correct?
That's right. Okay. So up to this point, this I can consider this equation as a quantum one. However, of course, what I'm doing here is I'm considering semi-classical limit to go back to my classical nonlinear equations. And it turns out that if lambda equals 1, I really cannot do that. When this gradient becomes large, this is already outside of semi-classical limit in the case when there are no interactions, when there are free fermions. So what I'm talking about is not applicable to free fermions, to hydrodynamics of free fermions. However, if I have finite lambda, then there is an interaction here, and there is a scale of those oscillations which still can be much larger than the distance between particles, and I can still be deep in the quasi-classical limit if the conditions for smallness of delta rho is satisfied.
I just want to follow up. I mean, the number of particles in the soliton is just.
The solitons in Benjamin Onna equations are quantized.
No, I know.
This is a specific.
And you go back to the particles.
It will be precisely the one particle per soliton. So these solitons, if you take this classical limit, you can probably interpret those solitons as just individual quasi particles of original size. These are the works of Sutherland on the classical limit.
The only connection of solitons is the quantization of the particle.
partial.
Що такого Лихозовського survival scripture по модам молодих? Полян і полам у
24 let me explain what it is. So this is the Sutherland model, so the same as Kolodziej model but on the circle, with just five particles, classical, as a quantum I don't know how to show. So classical systems, these are just particles in arbitrary initial positions, I just put them and this is how they typically move. Then I put my system, my particles in very special initial positions with very special velocities. And you can see that it's much more regular. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to do the same with 100 particles. I do not want to show 100 particles because it's not really that illuminating, but what I will show is the density of those particles on the circle from 0 to 2 pi.
And how would you... Is the angular momentum the same with these particles?
No, this I just dropped arbitrarily. This one has angular momentum 0.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, I just put them stationary from
the...
It does not matter because it's a classical system, you can rescale lambda away. So the value of lambda becomes quantum system in classical, it's not
perfect.
Yeah, that's right. So lambda going to infinity corresponds to classical limits. So when lambda times lambda minus 1 becomes lambda squared, this is lambda to infinity. Okay, so let me show you this picture. So this is how the density of 100 particles move. And this is the circle from 0 to 2 pi, it's periodic. And this is how it moves. So again, this is just simulation of the motion of Kolodziej particles. I just put initial conditions which I know should correspond to the soliton of collective theory. And indeed, you can see that this is pretty much Lorentzian-shaped soliton. Okay. It cannot find the most interesting models. Okay, so this is the picture which I described how it works. So you start with initial profile, then it steepens in time, then oscillations develop on the front of that profile, and then they spread away, and then they result in this train of solitons. So this is how dispersive shockwaves look like. Shockwave is not really a good term here. It's just used in the place where a dissipative system would have shockwave, we have this instead. So that's why we call it dispersive shockwave.
So this is U.
This is U, right? This is U of Benjamin-Onna equation. This is initial condition. This Lorentzian profile, but with area much bigger than 1. This is usually the problem which is easy to solve. And then we show the just different time slices. First, it goes as if there is no dispersive term, because dispersive term is small compared to nonlinear term, so it steepens. Then,
when gradient
becomes large, the dispersive term starts to play a role and oscillations develop. And then this is at time going to infinity, they become independent solitons.
Is the last author here Matsuo?
Matsuno. Yes, so Matsuno. This is Japanese guy who wrote about 100 papers about Benjamin-Onna equations. So he has all results. Okay, so let me try this. That doesn't work. It didn't find movie. I'll try to show you later. What about this one? No. Okay, sorry about that. So I will try to do something, to show something after break if there will be time. Yes? That's what I'm basically finished. What will happen here, this is the simulation for the same Sutherland model with 300 particles, and that's initial Lorentzian profile with area 3. So what will be seen there is how it decays into 3 Lorentzians of different size, but of the area 1 each. I'll show you on a laptop after during the break if somebody's interested. So that's it. So what I'm trying to say is that nonlinear and dispersive corrections are important. There are some phenomena which cannot be described in linear approximations. And the project which I'm working on now with my collaborators is to find those phenomena in one-dimensional systems. So Kolodziej-Rosatellite is of course not really that physical system, but it already shows some examples of that phenomena. And in other systems are like the age of quantum Hall effect and systems and larger relatives. Okay, thank you. Happy Halloween.
Okay, one question.
Yeah, so I just missed it, but I mean, if you have quantum particles, you can imagine some semi-classical limit. How many particles are in your solitons? That's not quantized number of particles.
In solitons, let me.
In terms of original particle density.
Just one particle.
One particle.
Yes.
Okay. But what's a little confusing to me is that I'm loving the liquid. Somehow I thought the right moving quantized charge becomes, different than integer, right? I mean, it's like a bit.
That's right. In Lattenger liquid, this quantization of charge is kind of lost. It's kind of density waves, and you can make profiles with any area.
So somehow the nonlinear terms give you back the quantization of your charge? The
precise balance between nonlinear term and dispersive term gives back quantization. So basically the area of the solitons is the ratio of the dispersive term and coefficient in front of dispersive term and a linear term in this equation.
But in a quantum system, that would be 1.
In a quantum system, if you derive it, it will be just 1. The ratio will be 1. So this is kind of tricky thing about classical limit, because there are quasi-particles and quasi-holes. And in particular, in Kolodziej-Rosatellite, one of them behaves as an integer and it does not have good classical limit. I believe particles and holes do have this quantization. This was discussed by Sutherland, but it's not really that clear.
I'm afraid you have to make great and convincing arguments. Mm-hmm.